Welcome to CPAC Today in Politics. Coming up, the tariff battle between Canada and the United States is over.
There was no one breakthrough moment. It was just a lot of steady conversations between Chrystia, between Bill, between the rest of our team and their counterparts. Lots of conversations with the president over the past weeks. An understanding as well that these tariffs were harming workers and consumers on both sides of the border.
Green Party leader Elizabeth May says the Liberals should try to hang on to government even if they don't win the most seats in the next election.
I think Canadians vastly, certainly the polling the Liberals did during the Electoral Reform Committee, the results overwhelmingly showed Canadians preferred the idea of many smaller parties working together than one party having all the power.
And the government prepares to announce details of a new digital charter to fight against hate speech and misinformation.
What we see in this digital charter is hints of further crackdowns to come, but a general statement of principles on what Canadians are entitled to expect from their data and information.
It's Tuesday, May the 21st. I'm Mark Sutcliffe. Let's get right to the top political stories this morning. I'm joined by Susan Delacourt, the Ottawa Bureau Chief for the Toronto Star. Good morning, Susan.
Good morning, Mark.
So the tariff battle with the United States is over, but this isn't the end of the discussion around trade with the U.S., of course. There are still many facets to this. What did we learn from this battle, and where does it go next?
Well, I guess what we learned of interest to me was the difference between last year and this year. I think we're coming up on the year anniversary of when Trump, first of all, when the tariffs were levied, and when Trump went on a blaze on Twitter against Justin Trudeau, calling him dishonest and weak and all kinds of other things, and his people were on television saying there was a special place in hell for him. It shows how much the relationship has, or at least temporarily, evolved since then, because Canada and the U.S. are talking again. I think, you know, we're going to hear some criticism from the opposition parties this week. We may even see some delaying tactics in the House. But it does show that on this big file, the Canada-U.S. file, I actually think some credit has to be given to the government for managing a very unpredictable and mercurial president simply by sort of staying at it. I think Chrystia Freeland gets a lot of credit for that, too.
Yeah, in many ways, Chrystia Freeland is the minister of the United States, not just the foreign affairs minister, right? She's
You're
the Trump
kidding.
Minister.
Huh.
Yeah.
Yeah. And she spent a lot of time cultivating those relationships, and their view, I believe, is first of all, Trump and Trudeau are talking. They were talking quite a lot through all of this, and they were comprehensive talks. Apparently, three phone calls in the last 2 weeks, lasting 20 to 25 minutes each, which is a long time for any political leader to stay on the phone. But also, this idea that the Canada has had from the very beginning is that the only way to pressure Trump is to surround him with congressional and governors and pressure from a multiple level of sources.
Right.
And I think that was what did it. Canada picked its timing very well, too. They waited for things to get really tense between the U.S. and China to show by way of contrast that Canada could be a friend and, you know, the old saying, the enemy of my friend is my friend or so
yeah.
and so. That Canada and the United States have formed at least some kind of working partnership here on the idea of their tensions with China.
Interesting. Now, of course, every relationship involving Donald Trump can be cyclical, not linear. So
yeah.
Stay tuned on that. But
exactly.
Let's turn to the digital charter that the Prime Minister announced last week. Your newspaper, the Toronto Star, has a few more details about that today. We expect an announcement from the government in the days ahead on exactly what it will include and how far it will go in reining in the social media companies and the other internet giants, the multinationals that have domain over the internet now.
Well, I don't think anybody should be comparing it to another Trudeau's charter. I don't think it's as sweeping or as substantial as that. But I think what the government is trying to do is nail down a few principles and hint. Again, there's no time before the election to pass any kind of concrete form of legislation. But what you're seeing, I see this almost as a step in the process. We've seen the government's patience with the big tech giants, Facebook, Google, et cetera, has been running out. And Karina Gould, the Democratic Institutions Minister, has been a little more forceful against what's going on Facebook and Google. And this digital charter is very much in that spirit, which is, you know, get your act together, Google and Facebook. And the idea of protecting Canadians' information and trust in those things, in those giants. So I think what we see in this digital charter is hints of further crackdowns to come, but a general statement of principles on what Canadians are entitled to expect from their data and information circulating out there.
Feels like it's just the starting point in what's going to be a long struggle to draw the lines in the right places in this space.
Yeah, again, I'm accused of already of harping on this, but I'm just, all the political parties are in a weak position on this one because their own use of data seems to be unregulated by any privacy laws. We're about to go into an election where all the data on Canadians is very important, and the political parties themselves, all of them, are not exactly stepping up to the plate here.
Yeah, effectively it puts them in a conflict of interest because any rules that would have to apply to them, or they would have to meaningfully exempt themselves from them, and they use data as much as or more than almost anybody else in Canada.
Exactly, and with the luxury of having no privacy laws over it.
Yeah. All right, let's talk about Green Party leader Elizabeth May, who did an interview with Althea Raj of HuffPost Canada on the follow-up podcast and said basically that the Liberals should try to hang on to government, even if they win fewer seats than the Conservatives in the next federal election, a scenario that is possible. But this is the kind of scenario that has sparked some pretty heated debate in this country before, and even a near constitutional crisis.
Exactly. Yes. Those of us who are a little bit constitutional junkies, a little bit, you don't have to have a long memory for this. As you say, it was 10 years ago that Canada was plunged into what was called then, I put it in quotes, a coalition crisis. It's actually part of a normal part of parliamentary doing business. We've seen other countries where, most recently Australia, where it is not unheard of for parties to cooperate to try to see who can form government.
Right.
I fully expect the Conservatives to be hauling out their old rhetoric about, you know, the unholy coalition. And I don't even think the Liberals want to acknowledge that they may win fewer seats than they
of
are
course.
Now. So
yeah.
Some of this is hypothetical. What it does call for, and in the wake of that, again, in quotes, coalition crisis, several academics in Canada, I actually went to a couple of the meetings too, actually sat down and said, we need some better rules in Canada about government formation. We are now operating on 150-year-old, you know, dusty old tomes of how governments are formed. We don't, unlike many countries, have rules. So this is still uncharted territory.
Yeah.
I think before all the rhetoric starts about unholy coalitions or even what Elizabeth May is saying, it would be a good idea for Canada to reacquaint themselves with how governments are formed in minorities.
Yeah, it's worth pointing out there are, I think, two competing things at play here. There are many facets to this, but one is the fact that technically speaking and by convention in Canada, the Prime Minister is not the leader of the party with the largest number of seats in the House of Commons necessarily, but
right.
The leader of the party that has the confidence of the House of Commons, which could be in a minority parliament situation, the party that has the second highest number of seats. Having said that, the system has to be credible and has to has to, the public has to buy into whatever outcome is achieved. And if it looks like a distortion of the electoral result, then that, while that prime minister might have the confidence of the House of Commons, he or she may not have the confidence of the Canadian electorate. And that would create a bit of a crisis on its own. So those two things might sometimes be in conflict with each other.
That is such an eloquent and important point you're making there. It is all that is exactly true. And I think it may be expecting too much for Canadians to spend their summers reading the rules of how Parliament is formed. But I think before all the nonsense starts on both sides, and I guess Elizabeth May she's not raising nonsense. She's raising a very plausible situation. I think before we start running off everywhere, we should reacquaint ourselves with some civics about this, because it could very well be the case that things are going to be not so clear after the election.
Yeah, and very quickly, we should point out that why is Elizabeth May raising this now? Perhaps in part because she doesn't want votes to migrate from the Green Party to the Liberals if it looks like Andrew Scheer and the Conservatives are going to finish with the highest number of seats, right?
Which she feels has happened before.
Yeah, and so that's a defensive move on her part, basically.
Exactly,
yeah.
Yep.
All right, great stuff, Susan. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Okay, Mark, thank you. Have a good week.
That's Susan Delacourt, the Ottawa Bureau Chief for the Toronto Star.
Obviously, we are deeply disappointed by the backsliding on women's rights that we're seeing in some places around the world, including in some American states.
Now, here's what political columnists and commentators are writing about today. In an editorial, the Toronto Star argues women's rights are under threat. The Star writes, "Why should Canada worry? The 300 anti-abortion bills have been introduced so far this year south of our border. Because if history has made one thing clear, it's that women's rights are fragile and constantly under threat of being extinguished for political purposes. When they are undermined in any country, that emboldens those who would try to curb them elsewhere." In the National Post, Chris Selly argues, "Draconian American abortion laws are irrelevant to Canadian politics." Selly writes, "Conservative governments in Canada are not in the habit of restricting abortion rights. Nevertheless, Status of Women Minister Maryam Monsef warned last week that an Andrew Scheer-led government might take us backward by restricting or undermining a woman's right to choose. Politicians making these warnings should be called out for what they're doing, fanning fears for partisan and financial gain." In the Globe and Mail, Dave Meslin argues, "Our survival requires a political teardown." Meslin writes, "Legislatures have descended into mob-driven battlegrounds. Centralized power within parties has transformed our elected representatives into trained seals who clap or jeer on cue. Growing cynicism among voters is leading to lower levels of political participation. Corporate lobbyists continue to wield enormous influence. All of this is holding us back from what we are capable of. It's time to change course." Now, let's look at what's coming up on Canada's political agenda. As we've discussed, the tariff battle between Canada and the United States is over, but there is still more to play out. CPAC's Martin Stringer has more on what to watch for in the days and weeks to come.
Mark, after the announcement of the lifting of tariffs on Monday, the Canadian government lifted the last of our retaliatory duties, which we had imposed on U.S. steel and aluminum, but also on another 70 targeted U.S. products, including coffee, ketchup, bourbon, sleeping bags, and other products all chosen to make American producers feel the maximum sting from the trade war. Those tariffs are gone, but the Canadian government has collected more than $1.27 billion in duties over the past year. All of it has been promised to go to Canadian steel and aluminum producers. In fact, the Trudeau government has committed to almost $2 billion in compensation. So what to watch for over the next few days and weeks is how much Ottawa deems Canadian producers will still be eligible to claim in damages from the year's worth of tariffs now that the trade war is over. So far, Canadian producers have only received a fraction of what they have been promised. So that's one thing to watch for. The second is obviously the fact that Ottawa had told the Americans that the Canadian Parliament would not be given the new NAFTA treaty to ratify if the tariffs were still in place. Well, now that they're gone, will Ottawa move quickly to bring that trade pact to a vote? Many observers have said there's really no gain in it for Canada, as it's not expected that NAFTA 2 will be passed by the U.S. Congress for as much as another year. So might the Trudeau government, either by intent or by legislative logjam, leave the ratification of NAFTA 2 to the next parliament after the fall election?
Thanks, Martin. Also today, in Sept-Îles, Quebec, the Prime Minister will meet with employees of Illuminière Alouette Incorporated. Later, he'll be in private meetings in Kamloops, British Columbia. Environment Minister Catherine McKenna will speak with the media in Toronto. Justice Minister David Lametti will make a funding announcement in Vancouver. Minister of Border Security Bill Blair will also be in Vancouver to make a funding announcement under the National Crime Prevention Strategy. In Moncton, New Brunswick, Minister of Families Jean-Yves Duclos will talk about government support for low-income workers. Later, in Kwispamsis, New Brunswick, he'll speak about the Canada Child Benefit. Employment Minister Patty Haidu will make an announcement in Montreal. Also in Montreal, Tourism Minister Melanie Joly will make an announcement about strengthening Canada's tourism sector. National Revenue Minister Diane Leboutillier will make an announcement in Havre-aux-Maisons, Quebec. Democratic Institutions Minister Karina Gould will make a funding announcement in Oakville, Ontario. Infrastructure Minister François-Philippe Champagne will attend an infrastructure event in Whitechurch, Stouffville, Ontario. Rural Economic Development Minister Bernadette Jordan will attend an infrastructure event in Iqaluit in Nunavut. And Minister for Women Mariam Monsef will be at an announcement in Toronto. And that's CPAC Today in Politics for Tuesday, May the 21st. Tune into Primetime Politics tonight on CPAC for coverage of all the day's events. Our podcast returns tomorrow morning. Have a great day.